at the Tennessee Art Site, the Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, the Kona Lavracha. I knew Rabbi Bernstein in New York. Rabbi Bernstein was the rabbi of the Jewish Center in New York, a position that Rabbi Young had held for many, many years. And I remember that I had a number of very interesting conversations with him. Every rabbi needs a rabbi to talk to. But he needs a rabbi to talk to that won't tell anybody that this rabbi is talking to him. Because we all have to be omniscient. And so we used to discuss things every so often, both personally and on the phone. We had an affinity for each other. And he would say, "How can anyone be a rabbi for Americans?" And I would say to him, "How can an Irishman be a rabbi for anybody?" And he said, "Beryl, you hit the nail on the head." And then in England, Rabbi Bernstein invited me to be a guest speaker for the Moriah School, and we met a few times. He was a great person. And a great person is a multifaceted person. It's hard to get a handle on him. Because as Rabbi Cooperman pointed out, he was a symphony. He was composed of many, many different parts. And that's what I thought of when I wanted to speak tonight about the rabbinate, because in reality, the rabbinate also is a symphony. Sometimes there are discordant notes, but it is a symphony. It's made up of many, many different parts. When I was a rabbi in Miami Beach, I once overheard a conversation between two Florida non-Jews, rednecks, and there was a long article in the paper that day about rabbis, and one said to the other, "Rabbis, rabies, what is that?" And the other one said, "It's a Jewish disease." Coravelloenis. In the history of the Jewish people, the rabbinate has taken on many, many different roles. It's a constantly evolving and changing profession. Because it is, so to speak, the profession of the frontline soldier. And the Rosh Yeshiva, the scholar, the person in the think tank. So that's one area of Jewish life. We could not be without them. But the person that's in the trenches, that's in, right there, that has to deal with the people, that's a different job completely. And the Rav throughout Jewish history has been that person. And therefore, as society's changed, and as the requirements of society's changed, the role of the rabbi also changed. There are certain basic minimum standards, so to speak, that always exist. It says in the Mishnah in Avot, "Aseh lecha rav." Strange language. Asei lecha rav. Make for yourself a rav. Our Rebbe used to say, Mendel always used to say, "Why is asei lecha rav? Make for yourself a rav." He say, "Bechar lecha rav. Pick a rabbi, you know. Study by a rabbi." What does it mean to make for yourself a rabbi? He used to say, every human being has clay feet. There are no perfect people, all rumors to the contrary notwithstanding. There just aren't. And therefore, Chazal teach us, for instance, that Moshe Rabbeinu, who's the prototype of all Jewish leadership, so the Jewish people, Ben Amram, they call them. You know, "Oh, Amram's kid. How come he's late today? How come he's early today? He had a fight with his wife. Look how good he looks. Why shouldn't he look good? Look at the salary you're paying him." There's all words in the Medrash. "Look how bad he looks. He doesn't take care of himself. He doesn't care about us." Why does the Medrash do that? What's the purpose here? The purpose is to explain to us, "Aseh lecha rav." You have to make for yourself a rav. And therefore, just as the Rav has to be, my father of blessed memory used to tell me, he said, "Beryl, a rabbi has to be half blind and half deaf, and most of the time mute. You can't see everything, and you can't hear everything, and you don't have to respond to everything. Because if you see everything, you're ineffective. And if you hear everything, you can't get out of bed in the morning. And if you're busy answering, so then you have no time to do anything else in your life. So I say, l'chorav, make for yourself a rabbi. Build him. Give him not just the benefit of the doubt, but the ability to overlook things. And that's a two-way street. Because, as I mentioned before, that's how rabbis have to look at the Jewish people as well. You have to be able to overlook Jewish people. And that was really Moshe Rabbeinu's great contribution, is that he somehow was able to be a great person. And Moshe says the harshest things in the world to the Jewish people. Mamri me'isem yom yadati asem. You're always rebellious. Am k'she'orev. Moshe Rabbeinu's love for the Jewish people was unquestioned. The rabbis teach us that when the Jewish people made the egel, so Moshe defends them in heaven. What does Moshe say? It's not their fault, it's your fault. You gave them too much money. Jews don't know how to handle money. Chazal said, Noah ani yusa l'Yisrael. We know how to handle poverty better than affluence. They know what to do with our money. Money is one of the supreme tests in life. So Moshe says to God, it's your fault. Yishvat aleim rov tova. Look what you gave them. All the wealth of Egypt, the gold and silver, everybody's a millionaire. What do you want from them? Certainly they made an egel. That's in heaven. On earth, Moshe comes down, he grinds the egel into dust, and he makes them drink it, and he makes a civil war, and he kills thousands of Jews. Atem chatosim, you have made a great sin. Moshe taught us a lesson here. The lesson is that God doesn't want to hear complaints from us about the Jewish people. In heaven, we have nothing to say bad. We only have to say good. You have complaints about the defects of the Jewish people, tell it to them. Tell it to the person. So the Rishoner says, well, see, so all of chet, don't take the chet up to heaven. Don't raise the man's sin to heaven. You come to God and say, this guy cheated me. Tell it to him straight. Lo sis all of chet. And that was the greatness of Moshe, all of his life. Whenever the Jewish people sinned, he defends them in heaven. But he castigates them on earth. My father-in-law, blessed memory, who was a Rav for over 60 years, so he was a Rav in Europe and for over a decade in Lithuania and then for over 50 years in Detroit. So he once told me, exquisite wry sense of humor, otherwise he couldn't have put up with me as a son-in-law, so he said, the difference between an American rabbi and a European rabbi, the Litvisher Rav, he said, what's the real difference? He said, the Litvisher Rav used to say a drasha, he used to deliver a sermon. At the end of the sermon, one man came over to him and said, Rebbe, heint is gewendish kosher. Today was not bad. So he went home and he told his wife, today we knocked them out, we killed them. Right? Today was terrific. He said, an American rabbi delivers a sermon, 50 people come over to him and say, Rabbi, that was great, that was wonderful, it was inspiring, couldn't be better. One person came over to him and says, Rabbi, you know, today, I don't know what you said, it didn't really mean much to me. He goes home to his wife and says, how can I be a rabbi for such an ungrateful group of people? So it's a difference in expectations. And that's the Aseh L'Charav. It's a mutual understanding of the difficulties of the task. And we have in Ovos that it says, Shammai says, Snoes Arabanut, to hate it. So Gemara says, Abdullah Mekatzeret Yamin. The Gemara brings many proofs to that. So the Mefarshim all explain that that's a person that enjoys lording it over others. He enjoys the Rabbanut and the fact that he has power. It becomes personal ego. So that's Mekatzeret Yamin. But in the general sense, the Rabbanut, the ability to influence, the ability to be a presence for others, is one of the great demands of every society, of every Jewish society. And it's one that, if I may say so, in our time, is sorely needed. There's a great story that appears in the biography of the Aderet, Rabbeinu Eliyahu David Rabinowitz Tumim, who was the father-in-law of Rav Kook, Rav Kook's first wife. And it was a great gaon. He was the Rav in Slutsk and in Ponovich and Lita. It was a tremendous gaon. And the Rav in Yerushalayim was Rav Shmuel Salant. Rav Shmuel Salant was the Rav here over 70 years. To be a Rav in Yerushalayim 70 years is an accomplishment. And Shmuel Salant, when he was in his 90s, already felt that he couldn't do it anymore. So he invited the Aderet, he had invited a number of Rabbonim to come here, all of them came. And he invited the Aderet to come and take over, to become the Rav of Yerushalayim. And the Aderet wrote to his son-in-law, to Rav Kook, a letter regarding this offer. And he said in the letter as follows. He said, Yodea ani shani mekatzer yomai. I know that if I take the job, I am dooming myself to a shorter lifespan than otherwise I would have. Because he said, Shmuel Salant is still alive. And he said, it's min animna, it's impossible that once he shouldn't feel the fact that I took the honor away from him. Who will they wait for Kriya Shema? Who will they wait for Shmoneh Esrei? Who will get Shlishi? Who will get the Aseret HaDibrot? Who will get the honors of the Rav? It's impossible, he said, that he won't have a flicker of frustration and disappointment. And he said, in heaven, anyone that causes tsar to a tzaddik's tsar is always taken into account. So he said, Yodea ani shani mekatzer yomai. He said, Avol moese, ahavosi l'Yerushalayim govro olai. What can I do, he said, my love for Yerushalayim, you know, way before the Zionists, way before the state, way before anything. It's the reason that we're here. The reason that we're here is because of this emotion that the Jewish people had. And without it, we're worthless. And with it, we're impregnable. Avosi l'Yerushalayim govrolai. My love for Jerusalem is even greater than my love of life. And he died before Shmuel Salant died. He came to Yerushalayim. They're buried together on Har HaZeitim. So, in certain times in the Jewish world, the Rav was the scholar. That was his job. His job was to sit and learn Torah. The famous legend that's attributed to many, many different people, a Rav came to a town, and 11 o'clock or 12 o'clock, all the lights were out in his house. The Balabatim said, what kind of Rav are you? You're not learning at night. I was a Rav in Miami Beach, so our home was back to back to the shul president's home, something which I don't recommend. There were months in Miami when you can have the windows open, you know, you don't need air conditioning, believe it or not, 4 or 5 months a year. So I would meet the shul president in shul in the morning, and he would say, "Who called you at 12 o'clock last night?" But, you know, he was supposed to learn. The Rav's job was to be a scholar. Now, it's interesting, there was a difference between the Sfardim and the Ashkenazim. And the difference came about in the late 13th century, early 14th century. Until then, no Rav drew a salary for being a Rav. Your Rashi was a vintner, a Bein Hatam dealt in diamonds. I mean, it's astounding for us to imagine such people. Rashi is running a wine business in the middle of all of this, right? And everybody was independent. We see that from the Tanoim, from the Amoroim. Everybody was doing their thing. Nobody took money. In the end of the 13th century and beginning of the 14th century, in Austria it happened, in Vienna, the Rabbonim began to draw a salary. The Kehila began to pay them. They saw that they needed a Rav and that it was more difficult for them to maintain themselves. And from then on in the Ashkenazic world mainly, Rabbonim have always got paid for being Rabbonim. In the Sephardic world that was not true. Till our time in the Sephardic world, the Sephardic Chacham was independent. Rav Nissim was one of the biggest real estate owners in Baghdad. And even though the halacha always was that you favored the Rabbonim in their business, but they all had their own business. They didn't. They weren't paid. It's only a late development that it's come. And that changed the nature of the Rabbonis. Because now the Rabbonis, he became a public servant. He lost part of his independence. No matter how strong a personality one is, but if you're getting paid by the Kehila, so then you're subservient to the Kehila to a certain extent. It's unavoidable. And therefore there were pressures, always pressures. The history of the Jewish people is replete with disputes between the rabbis and between the people who paid them. Because there never was a clear line of definition. Rabbi Saul Salanter said that when he got married, he and his wife agreed that in all matters of heaven he would decide, and in all matters of earth she would decide. And then he said that we spent our married life arguing over what were matters of heaven and matters of earth. What were milei d'shamayim and milei d'arav? Well, it's the same thing in the Rabbonis, right? It's clear, right? You're the Marta Atra, you're the one in charge of Halacha, right? So where does the line drawn? It was never clear. And there were certain disputes that were historic. In the city of Vilna, for instance, in the 1700s, the Rav was not the Gaon of Vilna, the Rav was of Shmuel Avigdor. And Rav Shmuel Avigdor and the Balabatim had a machlokas that lasted 35 years. That went to the government. I mean, it was Ad Lev HaShemayim. It was World War III. And when Rav Shmuel Avigdor died, the Balabatim placed a rock on his chair in the shul, and Vilna never took a rov afterwards. So, and the pious ones like to say they never took a rov afterwards because the Gaon of Vilna was there. But that's the historians say that that's not the reason. They never took a rov afterwards because they didn't want to have another 35-year machlokas like they had with Reb Shmuel Avigdor. And it was not until the Polish government in the 1920s forced the Jews to take a rov in Vilna. That there was a Rav, and then there was a great machlokas also as to which Rav to choose, a whole story. So it was always a difficult position, it was always tenuous, it was always full with tension and potential difficulties. The Rav was supposed to be the dayan in town, he was supposed to be the judge. Well, there's no more thankless job than being a judge for Jews. Because in the Din Torah that occurs, and Jews love Din Torah, they just love them. So in the Din Torah that occurs, so if there's a psak, so then one person or one group is, to put it mildly, disappointed. If they make a pshora, a compromise, then everybody is disappointed. Both sides are disappointed. If the rov is the dayan long enough in town, he ends up with nobody being on his side. And therefore, they separated the tasks so that in the cities and the small towns they couldn't, because they couldn't afford anybody, but in the large communities there were separate dayanim, and the rov was not in charge of deciding anything simply because it was too precarious. Then the rov was the posek, right? He had to paskin the shaylos. We talk about kashrus today, you know, and the standards of kashrus. I've always maintained that the standards of kashrus today are the best that the Jewish people have had probably since the time in the desert when they ate mon, which, by the way, was tofu. So the my father-in-law, blessed memory, told me that in his little town in Vashki in Litta, where he was the rav, every Wednesday night they shechted one behema a week, one animal a week for the whole town, and that was the meat for Shabbos. And he said every Wednesday night he and the shochet stood up all night to make the behema kosher, because there was only behema in town. The behema had 10-15 things wrong with it. And you had to put the elephant through the eye of a needle, you made it kosher. My father-in-law once asked me, he said, when you were the head of the OU, what did you learn? So I said, I learned that it's very hard for something to really be treif. So he said, that's correct. That's the lesson. So the rov was the posek. The paskin shilas for women, the paskin shilas and chickens. I remember my father, blessed memory, every Friday morning, ladies used to bring him chickens to look at. I was a small child and I was fascinated. I said, what are you showing you the chickens, Daddy? He explained to me, you know, there can be a problem. I didn't know, I was maybe 4 years old. I don't know anything. So I said, can I do it too? He said, well, he said, you can sit here with me. I was an only child. So he said, you can sit here with me and look at the chickens too, right? But every Friday morning there were chickens. I had a woman in Miami Beach. I haven't had a chicken here in Jerusalem, but in Miami Beach, I had a woman that brought me a chicken every Friday morning. No matter what. And she, I used to tell her, that, you know, it came packaged with a hefsher, kosher bait. I mean, what are you bringing me the chicken? What can I do? And she would say, my mother used to bring a chicken. I'm bringing the chicken. So the rub was the posek. The rub was the posek. He had the pasuk and the shaylas. In the big cities, that also was a problem. Because if the rav, for instance, was too machmir, you know, so the butchers would complain. He would lose his authority. So in the big cities, there were poskim, that their job was to paskin. The rav, Reb Chaim Brisker and Brisk, never paskin the shaylas. Never. That was Reb Simcha Zelig Rieger. He was in charge. Wasn't his department. There's a famous, where I was speaking about the Aderis. The Aderis writes in his autobiography that in Ponevish he once had a machoikas with the Balabatim. So the Balabatim withheld his salary for 16 weeks. Sarho Tzach. Right? It's a way to bring them down, don't they? So 16 weeks, he said, and they didn't have any more resources. He couldn't borrow any more money. So he did what, what Amir Peretz does. He made a shvita klalit. He wouldn't paskin any shaylos. Women came with shaylos of Nida. There were shaylos in the mikveh. He's not there. He's not in town. The Balabatim were furious. So they took him to Rav Yitzchak, and this is what he writes. They took him to Rav Yitzchak Elchanan, who was the Rav in Kovna, the chief Rav in Lita. And they said to him, tell our Rav, what do you mean he made a Shemitah? So Rav Yitzchak Elchanan said, the rabbi is right. He said, when I was the Rav in the Varadok, they didn't pay me also for 10 weeks. I also stopped basketing. Pay him the money. So I know that that interferes with our idyllic fantasy of what Eastern Europe was, but it makes the reality of the Rabbonis real to us. And that there was a tension-filled, tension-laden profession. From the most Moshe Rabbeinu till today. They once asked, therefore, Reb Chaim Brisker, listen, you don't paskin shilas. You're not the dayan in town. You speak twice a year, Shabbos Shuvah and Shabbos HaGadol. There are 52 weeks we don't hear from you. What are we paying you for? So the same shayla was asked to Reb Yitzchak Elchanan. Reb Yitzchak Elchanan's answer is, I get paid for wearing the black frock in summer. Which in Jerusalem really you earn your money. But the Reb Chaim said a Rav's job today is to be a Baal Chesed, to save Almonas and Yesomim, to be good to the Jewish people. He said, that's my job. My job is to be good to the Jewish people. And in Brisk, for instance, it was famous that Jewish foundlings, babies that were born of questionable parentage, Jewish babies, were left on the doorstep of Reb Chaim. And Reb Chaim would raise them, marry them off, take care of them. In Brisk, they used to laugh and say, Reb Chaim's mamzerim. But Reb Chaim said over and over again, my job is to take care of the widow and the orphan, of the helpless. That's my job. That's the job of the Rav. In our time, if I may say so, because of all the social institutions and everything else that exists, Jewish life has become so organized. I have always felt that the task of the Rav, and this is where Rabbi Bernstein, I felt, was really the epitome of it, was someone that provided perspective and vision, was the great communicator, who was able somehow to take his congregations, the people that he addressed, the people that knew him, to give them a connection to Sinai, that they should hear the shofar of Mashiach, that they should feel good about being a Jew, they should be proud of it. That's the job of a Rav. And that's a very ephemeral thing. You can't measure it, right? I once went and asked a very wealthy man in New York for money for one of my projects. I'm making a number of films regarding great Jews and regarding Jewish history. So he said to me, how many Balei Tshuva did you make? I said, I don't know of one. I said, but I think I affected thousands and tens of thousands of people. And I think that that counts also. So a Rav cannot measure his success in numbers because we can't tell. Rabbi Bernstein's tapes are still around. And people still listen to them. A Jew in San Diego hears a tape from Isaac Bernstein, and all of a sudden, in him, a switch goes on. And he's interested. So that's the job of the Rav, to be the great communicator. Vayered Moshe El Ha'am. Moshe went down to the people. Vayadaber Moshe, Eli Advorim Asher Diber Moshe. Moshe begins, Ish Kvad Peh, Kvad Loshon Anochi, I can't speak. Moshe at the end is the most verbose of all. Never stops speaking. Because Moshe is the great communicator. Torah Tziva Lonu Moshe. Zichru Torah's Moshe Avdi. We live for Moshe. We hear his voice every Shabbos. We respond to his nuances. And we're stirred by his example. We're inspired by him. So bim zer, in a little way, every Rav is responsible for that as well. That's the measure of today's rabbinate. Here in Israel we have an official rabbinate, as Rabbi Kopperman says, that's a different shear completely, which I'm not going to enter into. It's a whole different ballgame. But for the plain rabbi, you know, the rabbi in, with the congregation, the rabbi that's teaching, the rabbi that's involved with people, his job is to be the community. He has to give the vision. He has to somehow show them the great world of Judaism, the great past and the even greater future. And that was always the measure of greatness. Chazal said, "Kol hamizakeh sarabi min chet bo al yodo." A person that deals with the rabbi, with many people, and he gives them mizakeh. Mizakeh is he gives them a schiyot. He gives them good things. Because of him, good things happen. So he is saved from sin. The Gemara has a simple cheshbon why, a simple explanation why. The Rav is going to be in hell, and everybody that he influenced is going to be in Gan Eden. Zelo fair. So God therefore has to make it that the Rav is also saved. I used to tell my Balabatim in Mamsui, you know that I'm counting on you. You got to do it. It's up to you. And the Gemara says the opposite. The kol amachti asarabi. Someone that brings into sin or into disrepute the Jewish people. Ain't must speak in biyodo lasos tshuva. Can't do tshuva on it. Impossible. Why? The Gemara says the same thing. Shelo yehu began Eden v'talmidov. To Gehenna. How can he be in Gan Eden and all of his students are in Gehenna? So it's a partnership. Rabbonus was always a partnership between the community and between the rabbi. And the task was to try and get both of them to Gan Eden. And the important thing from that Gemara is that a Rav should always try to get his Balabatim to Gan Eden because that's his ticket. If he goes to Gan Eden, it doesn't mean that it's going to happen, right? He may end up taking the elevator down. Shelo yehu v'gehenna v'talmido v'Gan Eden. And I always felt in the Rabbonis that if a person had that outlook to raise the people, Rei ato omer elai, Moshe says to God, you told me what the task is. Halas omazeh. Raise the people. Make them better, bigger. Let them see what they are. Don't let them wallow in the dust. That was always the task. And that task remains as vital, perhaps more vital than any other task that a Rav can have. And for that, therefore, the Rabboni Shalom gave talents. Rabbi Bernstein had a great sense of humor. Rabbi Bernstein was a great orator. I used to tell him that, you know, the Irish brogue will carry you through, right? Doesn't make any difference what you say. I said, if you had a Polish accent, you'd never hold a job, right? But the way you talk, you know, people love the lilt. But he was a great orator. Was able to, not only an orator in terms of being able to give a public address, being able to speak to people on a level that they understood. There's a famous story that a chassid came to the Kotzker, and the chassid was bragging to the Kotzker about his Rebbe. So he said, mein Rebbe written Himmelarein. My Rebbe is in heaven. He speaks, you know, it's in heaven. And the Kotzker said, ich red in Pupikarein. I'm talking to you. We're not talking in heaven. There are lots of great Jews that are talking in heaven. It's hard to relate to them. Who knows what they're talking about? Who understands it? Who appreciates it? But somebody has to talk to Jews on their level. How is Almazeh? To raise them, to inspire them, to give them that sense of vision. And he had that gift. And that gift lives on after him because of his wisdom in making tapes and therefore allowing generations later to benefit from Rabbi Bernstein. Finally, Chazal say, Kisifsei Choin Yavakshu. Yivakshu das, right? That the Torah Yivakshu Mipiyu. The Kohen, the leader, he is the repository of knowledge, and people come to him for Torah. So the end of the pasuk is Kimalach Hashem Tzvakosim. He's the Malach. He's an angel. So the Gemara says in one of its frightening, honest appraisals, if people think of him as a messenger of God, then Torah Yavakshu Mipil, people will want to come and learn Torah. But if people don't see it on him, he can be the most brilliant person in the world, he can be the most talented person in the world, but you don't see that as a Malach Hashem Tzvokos. You don't see the holiness in him, you don't see the fire, you don't see Sinai in him. So then lo yivakshu, then they're not going to come. And that remains the litmus paper test of the rabbinate until today. It has not changed. And so that's a daunting challenge. It's not something that's easily accomplished. And people who accomplished it, therefore should receive not only our approbation and appreciation, but we should understand and feel the gift that the Lord gave us, the gift for English Jewry and for portions of American Jewry for a life far too short. It was Rabbi Isaac Bernstein, Zichrono Livracha. His son continues in his path with his wonderful Parsha Shir every week here in Yerushalayim. And my wife is one of his loyal students, and I hear the tape the next day. My only objection to it is that nothing that he says can I use on Shabbos in my sermons, because most of the people have heard it already. But again, it's the communication, the ability to communicate Torah, to communicate perspective, to communicate wisdom and holiness. Yehi Zichro Baruch, and may the Rabboni Shalom bless all of us, that this coming good year should bring to us Yeshuos v'Nechomos. We'll be zochet together to Ktiva Chtima Tova, Lono V'Chol Yisrael. Amen.